wanted to begin this session. It's not just about antiquity, it's about the contemporary Jewish demographic scene. And since many of you have been kind enough to ask, I want you to know that as an addition to the Jewish people, a grandson, it happened at 11 o'clock Monday in Jerusalem, which is 1 a.m. this morning here. So if I kind of lose my train of thought and kind of wander off, you'll know that it's to do from a little lack of sleep and stuff. Everyone's fine. Thank you. I should tell you that we call him JC. Why? Because my daughter is married to a Cohen, and since we don't know his name, we call him Junior Cohen. So until Shabbat, he's JC. Okay. Okay. Here, let's give these out. I guess you should pass backwards or something. We really could spend easily the whole, whatever time, three-quarters of an hour reading this text and discussing it, but since I'm interested in the implications and background, we're going to do this, the textual part, rather quickly, and I'm more than happy to stick around afterwards to do it in more depth on certain, if people are interested in that. But I do want to get to the historical implications and background. Just to put this lecture in a perspective, since a lot of faces are familiar to me from previous lectures, as I saw hands raised, this lecture is complementing what we discussed yesterday in the synagogue and also on Thursday. We touched on a number of occasions on the question of Hellenization. Just as anybody talking about the same, it's the same source, it's the same piece of paper. You just have to take one sheet. Okay? Just as today, I think anybody, including Ari's very creative ideas for fundraising, would be hard pressed to understand what goes on in American Jewish life without understanding the American context. The American context, because lots of things we have adopted for our good, and certainly it has enhanced Jewish life. Same thing with Hellenization. You have to remember in Jewish history that we Jews living in the 20th and 21st century, have a lot in common with the Jews of antiquity. Where we don't have a lot in common, and again, it's degree, it's a matter of degree, with the Jews of the Middle Ages. And that is, relatively speaking, there was a great deal of contact and movement and what I called once the marketplace of ideas in the ancient world as we have it today. And there was a lot of movement and ability to adopt and to practice various things, beliefs, customs, whereas it happened in the Middle Ages as well. It's not a matter of black and white, but it was much more limited. Much more limited in time, and much more limited geographically. So that in that sense, when we talk about Hellenization, as we have mentioned referred to, that kind of interfacing with the culture around is what happens today and happened then. Now, just as today, there are many rabbis who are in the forefront of certain changes that should take place to keep Judaism relevant, so it was in the past. I told the story yesterday, and I'll just repeat it very briefly, because it's a great story, a tradition, but it's also very relevant to keep in mind. I told the story about two rabbis coming into a synagogue in Caesarea around the year 300, and they heard the congregation reciting Shema Yisrael in Greek. Okay, now a test. Anybody who was at that, what's the continuation? One rabbi. Stop it. One rabbi was offended, didn't think it was right. Interesting, why? Because you're allowed to do that in the Mishnah. You're allowed to say the Shema in any language you want. But he was obviously very strict, and you can't do it. All right? The other rabbi, somebody else?
Said that it's great, better that they're saying it in Greek than not
Very
at
good.
All.
Thank you, man. Better they should say it in Greek than not at all. And here you have in a nutshell what I'll come back to toward the end. There is no, and I've said this before, no one monolithic rabbinic view, just as there's no such thing as a monolithic Jewish practice vis-a-vis Hellenization. Some communities did more and some communities did less. The same thing is true with the rabbis. Those people, sometimes scholars and certainly laymen, who try to pigeonhole the rabbis. The rabbis said this. The rabbis didn't like that. Whenever you hear that, know it's a generalization and therefore it's a distortion. And just as these two rabbis, okay, had very different views when they came and they met a new situation, or what for them was a new situation. A congregation not knowing enough Hebrew to say Shema Yisrael in Hebrew, and they had to do it in Greek, and you had different reactions, so it happens in many areas. And therefore, rabbis today as well. I know in the conservative movement, and I can't speak for others in the conservative movement, the rabbis 30 years ago were at the very forefront of advocating egalitarianism, even though a lot of congregants were very reserved, very hesitant. They weren't sure that that's what they want. That's not what they grew up with. By the way, the rabbis also who were opposed it. But those who were for it were that. Just as right now in Southern California, among the most vociferous advocates, for good or for bad, I don't want to judge it. Fact. Vociferous advocates of changes nowadays that should be implemented in service using musical instruments in the synagogue on Shabbat or the recognition of homosexuality, rabbis are in the forefront. Among those in the forefront are many rabbis as well. So you have that phenomenon in the past and in the present, and I want to deal with that today around a very focal institution, the Seder. And again, I want to remind, and this will end the introduction, as one of the points I tried to make yesterday was when one judges Jewish creativity, it's not just a matter of what the Jews did that nobody else did. What the Jews invented that nobody else had. Another category, which I think is far more prevalent, is what the Jews learned from the surroundings, what the Jews introduced into Judaism, into Jewish life, even though when it was a copy or based on models that they saw in the world around. And I would like to suggest that the example we're going to study for the next few minutes is probably the classic or one of the classic examples of the ability to adopt and adapt, which has had incredible and a powerful influence on Judaism the last 2,000 years. Because whether it's in Israel or in America, when you ask Jews, what do they observe? The vast majority, the one custom that's far and away observed by Jews everywhere is the Seder on Pesach. I don't care how you define the Seder. It can be traditional, it can be adaptive, it can be a meal that they just call a Seder. I mean, it could be a whole range of things. But there is an institution known as the Seder on Passover, which has become sacrosanct in 80 to 90 and above percent of the lives of the Jews throughout the world. And that's the focus of our discussion today. What you have here, and I apologize, I sacrificed aesthetics for efficiency. This is the famous translation of the Mishnah. This is the Mishnah by Danby, and I could get everything on one page, and it came out perhaps looking a little squinched. But we're not going to study this day and night, so we'll be okay. As you know, the Mishnah is divided into six sections, six sdarim. The Mishnah that was edited in the year 200 by Rabbi Judah the Prince. And the second of the six starim is Moed. Deals with holidays, Shabbat and holidays. And one of the tractates in Moed is Psachim, which deals with Pesach. And most of it deals with Passover in the temple. Kind of a throwback, what was. what sacrifices, when, etc. Some of it even deals with a holiday. I don't know how many of you are familiar with. It's called Pesach Sheni. Anybody know what Pesach Sheni is by chance? Yes.
Is that possibly if you missed, you were on the sea or something, and you missed the first Passover, you could go the following month and celebrate it?
Possibly. Absolutely possibly. Very good. All right. A month later, the 14th of Iyar, is Pesach Sheni. If you missed it, you could offer, in those days, offer your sacrifice, etc. I don't think you hold a Seder to them then, but I've never heard of that. But certainly in the days of the temple, you could, that's Pesach. So it deals, 9 of the 10 chapters deals with that. The last chapter deals with what we would call the Seder. Interesting. Added on to a whole compass. So let's now, what I did here is kind of outline, I don't know if you, can you see?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just outlined some of that. The highlights of what we're going to read, because I want to discuss these. What I put in parentheses here is stuff that's not in the Mishnah, but it's in other early sources. And that's also part of the thing. But we'll go as we go along. So let's go quickly. If you have questions, you know, I'll make a few comments, obviously, because I do want to get through them. But if you do have questions, we certainly will deal with them. So on the left-hand side, toward the top, it says 10:1. All right, that's chapter 10. And the first Mishnah, we're going to read the first 7 or so Mishnayot. So let's, if we can get some volunteers for each Mishnah, 1, 2, 3, that'll be great. That will add to the thing. Susan.
On the eve of Passover, from about the time of the evening offering, a man must eat not until nightfall.
All right. In other words, you're not allowed to eat before the evening offering is a very tricky translation. It really is a mincha offering. Let's say from roughly, without going about 3:30 on, you're not supposed to eat, so you can be hungry and enjoy the Passover. What other day you're not supposed to eat just before the holiday? Well, Yom Kippur until you the Sudam of Seket, all right? That's also, you know, there's a gap, but then you eat it later. Okay, let's go on.
Even the poorest in Israel must not eat unless he sits down to table, and they must not give them less than 4 cups of wine to drink, even if it is from the paupers.
Now, tamchui, that means, you know, from the poor, from the charity. Even if he has no money, he has to give for charity, he has to have 4 cups. Okay, so wine, I put as 1, the 4 cups of wine. That's the beginning, all right? Number 2, somebody else? Yes, please.
After they have mixed him his first cup.
That means poor. All right, this is what can you do? These are Englishmen who did this thing. Why don't the English learn to speak?
The school of Shammai say, he says the benediction first over the day, and then the benediction over the wine. And the school of Hillel say, he says the benediction first over the wine, and then the benediction over the day.
Okay. Now, as you all know, this has really nothing to do specifically with Passover. It has to do with Shabbat and Allah. As you know, when you say Kiddush, there are 2 brachot, 2 blessings. All right? The first is Borei Pri HaGafen. That's short. Short and sweet. Then comes a long one. Okay? The long one, which is Kiddush Hayom. Mekadesh Shabbat, Mekadesh Yisrael V'Azmanim. You know, it starts off Asher Bachar Banu. Bikolam on holidays, Asher Kiddushan of Mitzvotav. That's a long one. So there's a whole dispute between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. This is the first century. Which comes first? All right? Do you say the wine first and then the day, or the day and the wine? It's really not easy to fathom what the difference is. Why the dispute? Why does one prefer one and one prefer the other? I don't want to spend time on it because it really is not clear and everything is speculation. But as long as we're speculating, one suggestion made by Louis Ginsberg decades and decades ago, that was in a time when socioeconomic approach was very popular in historiography, he suggested the difference between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel was socioeconomic, okay? That what I have seen in Orange County is middle and up, okay? Very impressive middle and up. Although when I jogged around Newport Beach in Balboa, I also saw that God, you know, who knows, in Ocean County there's also, you know, middle and down. All right, I'm sure there's even lower than what I saw there, but I saw it. In any case, that Beit Shammai was the upper class and Beit Hillel was the middle lower class. Very nice. So what does that have to do with here? His explanation was very, very clever. I don't know if he's right. That the wealthy, you know, people can afford it, have wine every day. Beit Shammai have wine all the time. They can afford it. No big deal. And therefore, you say the blessing over wine second, because that's not something that really characterizes the day. You have to say the bracha on the special, the day itself. And then you say wine at the end because you have to say it on wine, but it's not that important. Whereas the lower class, Beit Hillel, the middle of lower class, who don't have the money, don't have the ability to have wine every day, they settle for Diet Coke or something like that, they, for them, wine is
special.
Wine is the sign of a special day, and therefore they do the wine first. By the way, I don't know if that's true or not true, but I want to tell you something. It worked in our family. When we first came to Israel, couldn't afford, didn't want to have Coke every day, and we had it on Shabbat. That was our kind of Shabbat treat. Among other things, we would have Coke. Our son was in the army, and he came back in the middle of the week, and you have to know, when your child goes in the army, when he, she comes home, you do everything. You do whatever they want. You know, you go out and buy so that, you know, this and that. So our son was back in the middle of the week, and we went out to get some steak, and we got this, and we got some Coke, and let him eat and let him enjoy. Our little daughter comes in, sees the Coke, and says, "Oh my God, it's Shabbat." it works sometimes, even in that. In any case, that's an explanation. Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai, interesting. Whatever the case is, that goes with Passover as well. Let's move on to number three. Somebody else. Yes, sir. When food
is brought before him, he eats it seasoned with lettuce until he has come to the breaking of bread. They break before him unleavened bread and lettuce and the charoset.
All right, everyone knows what charoset is?
Yes, sir.
All right, the nuts, apples mixed with wine. Supposedly stands for what?
The mud,
the mortar, how they had to build in Egypt, okay? Although charoset. Hello?
When is it? It's not a religious obligation.
All right, now that's the general point, but they bring a counter opinion. Go ahead.
Rabbi Eliezer, then.
Rabbi Yitzchak Tzadok, yeah.
It is a religious
obligation. All right, so he thinks it is. All right, so a dispute, it is or isn't. Go ahead.
And in the holy city, they used to bring before him the body of the Paschal.
All right, in other words, when they in Jerusalem, when they sacrificed the Paschal offering, that was the time to eat. So after the Kiddush, you had your appetizers, okay? There's some lettuce and this, and then came the bread and the main meal. Okay? Number four. Yes.
They then mix him the second cup.
Pour, right, okay.
And here the son asks his father, and if the son has not enough understanding, his father instructs him how to ask, why is this night different from other nights?
Okay, why is this night different? And this is the four questions. You'll notice, by the way, they got this question from Mel Gibson, because in the movie it says, Manishtana halayla hazeh. All right, that's to give the Jews or somebody else a little sense of authenticity. Whatever the case is. You'll see, we're going to read it quickly. If you're interested later, the four questions are not exactly the four questions we have. They've changed in the course of time. Again, I'm not going to relate to that now. If you're interested, we'll do it later on. Go ahead. Want to finish up?
For on other nights, we eat seasoned food once, but this night twice. On other nights, we eat leavened or unleavened bread, but this night all that is unleavened. On other nights, we eat flesh roast, stewed or cooked, but at this night, all is roast.
Those are the questions. All right, go ahead. And now we go beyond that. Right.
And according to the understanding of the son, his father instructs him.
Interesting.
He begins with the disgrace and ends with the glory.
All right, matchilim begnai mesayimim b'shvach. You start when things were bad, like we were in slaves in Egypt, or our patriarchs and matriarchs were wandering around, and you wind up b'shvach and glory about The Exodus. All right, they got out of Egypt.
And he expounds from a wandering Aramean was my father until he finishes the whole section.
Okay, very interesting. What does it say? It says, according to the understanding of the son, his father instructs him. In other words, it's open. What do you say afterwards? How you respond, that depends if you're talking to a 5-year-old, if you're talking to a 12-year-old, if you're talking to a, what are the four titles? Chacham, or Sheinei Yodei Lishol, or Rasha, Chas V'Chalila. Whatever the case, it has to be. And then, of course, since I have, there are here probably about 60 excellent educators, that's the way you teach. You start with where the student is, and you move from that. Okay? Let's go further. 5. Anybody? Please.
Rabban Gamaliel used to say, whosoever has not said the verses concerning these three things at Passover has not fulfilled his obligation.
All right, so he gives at least three things must be mentioned and be explained. What are they? Please.
And these are they. Passover,
unleavened bread, matzot,
and bitter herbs.
Okay, what are they? Passover.
Passover, because God passed over the houses of our fathers in Egypt. Unleavened bread, because our fathers were redeemed from Egypt. Bitter herbs, because the Egyptians embittered the lives of our fathers in Egypt. In every generation, a man must so regard himself as if he came forth himself out of Egypt, for it is written, and thou shalt tell thy son in that day, saying, it is because of that which the Lord did for me when I came forth out of Egypt. Therefore, we are bound to give thanks, to praise, to glorify, to honor, to exalt, to extol, and to bless him who has wrought all these wonders for our fathers and for us. He brought us out from bondage to freedom, from sorrow to gladness, and from mourning to a festival day, and from darkness to great light, and from servitude to redemption. So let us stay before him the hallelujah.
Okay. All right, so in other words, this is, by the way, what we recite. All right, this is straight from the Haggadah. And it's clearly, you know, the references to a historical event, the Exodus from Egypt. And it's the Hallel. All right? It's those 5 or 6 Psalms, 113, 118, I think, in the book of Psalms that are what's called the Hallel, and that is what is said at the end. And number 6 starts out, how far do they recite the Hallel? In other words, how much do you do at first? And before you add later on, and there's a difference of opinion, okay? Let's do number 7. Let's jump over to number 7. Anybody? Yes, please.
After they have mixed for him the third cup, he says the benediction over his meal. Over a fourth cup, he completes the Hallel and says it after the benediction over song.
Okay. All right, so there's a benediction over a song, there are more praises, and I want you to skip and just do the first line of 8. All right?
After the Passover meal, they should not disperse to join in revelry.
Okay, when the Passover is over, you don't go out and get drunk, as happened last night, as I can attest to. I want to tell you something, Balboa Peninsula, is that what it's called? Peninsula?
Island.
Oh, not island.
Here, the peninsula.
He was a peninsula.
Sorry.
I want to tell you people, it was jumping.
Yeah.
If you want to know what revelry is, in case you don't know, maybe you do it in your own house, it was there. And deep in the night, and even if you go out jogging at 6 in the morning, the breath of beer is everywhere. Okay? It's and a few people are zonked on the sidewalks. But that's something else.
We warned you.
It's okay. It was an experience. Everything, I know when I come to Southern California, experience. It's going to be an experience. Okay? That's good. All right. So here we have an outline. Okay? An outline of something to do on Passover. The question is, why, when, and who came up with this creation? Why do I say creation? Because all of the things that we've read here, with the exception, perhaps, of Kiddush, are never mentioned in earlier sources. In the First Temple and Second Temple sources, when they talk about Passover, 99% of the description of the ritual of Passover has to do with what?
The temple.
Absolutely. That is it. What the Jew did who didn't get the temple, we don't know. Did they do something and not do something? Was it kind of vicarious? Don't know. But whatever it is, everything was focused on the temple. So, here we find an interesting creation. Why was it created? Because it's obvious there's no more temple. All right? And once the temple went, which was the key to try to understand, to try to fulfill the Passover, you're left with a vacuum. What do you do? And Passover is an important holiday in terms of the crystallization of Jewish identity in antiquity as well as Medor Lador in every generation. All right? So what do you do? So there's a need, a tremendous need to fill the vacuum. Who did it? From everything we know in the Mishnah, both what we've read here and some of the additions, these were the rabbis, what we very often call in Jewish historiography, the rabbis of Yavne. Okay? I'm sure you've studied that or heard. Yavne was where Yochanan ben Zakkai, number of the sages, went after the destruction. It was a center of rabbinic activity for about 60 years, between the destruction of the temple and the outbreak of the war of the Bar Kokhba rebellion. All right, that's when Yavne in rabbinic life played a central role. All the rabbis mentioned here, all the rabbis mentioned in the Haggadah that we have, all of them come from this period. Here we have whom? Who is mentioned? Rabban Gamliel. Very important, by the way. He's not just mentioned. He is really saying that you have to say three things to be Yotze, to fulfill your obligation. So he kind of puts a minimalist halachic requirement, what has to be done. You also have Eliezer ben Tzadok, who's mentioned. But in addition to that, you have other names of sages that appear in other sources and in our Haggadah. For example, if you remember, how many miracles did God do? So there's some who say 10, and then 50, and then 250. All of those rabbis who exaggerate or expand on the miracles are from Yavne. And then you have an interesting thing. The story, all of a sudden, after the four questions, there's a break. And it says about five rabbis were sitting around the B'nai Brak in the home of Rabbi Akiva during Passover, reciting the story and talking about the story all night until their students had to come and say to them what? Higi Zman Kriyat Shema Shel Shacharit. It's already dawn. All right? It's time to say the morning prayers. So these five sages that are mentioned are all from Yavne. So we have why there was a need. We have who, the generation immediately following the destruction. Then the question comes from where? Where did they get this from? Where did they get some of these customs and presents? Is that Jewish creativity? The first model, in other words, they made it up, never existed before, or is this something of the second model, where they took something and they changed it and reworked it and reshaped it in order that it would fit the Jewish framework? Now I would like to suggest why the second, to me, seems to be preferable, absolutely preferable. You know, very often, I'm sure you've had this with other people who've spoken to you, people who deal with ancient Judaism, ancient Jewish history, always bemoan the fact, rightly so, we don't have sources. What can we do? We have limited sources. We can't answer all the questions. We don't know all the things. We do the best we can with what we have. But there's one area that we have sources. The Romans, a number of Roman writers spent a lot of time talking about festive meals that the Romans used to organize. And these festive meals are called symposia.
Orgies.
Did somebody say orgies?
Say orgies. The orgy was afterwards.
Do you know something? I think Plato would be terribly offended.
No,
if you go to a philosophy class and the teacher says, we're going to read Plato's Symposium. And you said, orgy. Oh, my God. That would
but there was an orgy after the symposium. And the
Passover. Again.
You said the word after, and it's not. That's after. I'm talking about what is a symposium. The Romans, the Greeks, by the way, and the Romans, okay, used to have these large meals where they would invite people, and sometimes not just friends, but also at least token itinerants, poor, to come and join, but whatever the case. And it was usually organized around a holiday, either of some god or the coronation of a king or an emperor or somebody's birthday. Lots of reasons. You have a lot of symposia during the year. Okay, like many of you people have lots of dinner parties during the year. And the symposia usually had two aspects, two components. One was a meal, a nice festive meal. And the second was a discussion on philosophy. All right, abstract discussion of what is beauty, what is justice. All right, these are the classic themes from Plato on that were often discussed at a symposium. Now, because we have literature on the symposia, we now have an idea of not only what went on there, but how people wrote about it. Pay attention. Not only what went on there, but how people described it. For example, in the symposia, very often, a person who sent out invitations would send out invitations, besides to his friends, to people in need. Kol dichvin yetev yechol. The beginning of the Seder of Passover, all who need, who are hungry, should come and participate. Interesting parallel. And then, when they start the symposia, how do you break the ice? Well, we have all kinds of seminars today. What's it called? How do you get people involved?
Icebreakers.
Is that what it's called? Icebreakers? Yeah. Even I knew that. All right, I thought maybe it was some fancier word than icebreaker. Okay, so in any case, and one of the ways in symposia that they always broke the ice was to ask questions. And usually very simple questions. And very often very simple questions about food. Why is this food healthy? This is going great today. Why is this food healthier than other food? Why is it better? This is for the Marguerite. Why is it better to eat food from the sea, fish, than meat? I mentioned that because we had salmon yesterday at Laguna Beach. Okay? Why? So in other words, all kinds of. Everybody knows the answer. There's no great chokhmah here. But there was a way of getting people to. Ma nishtana halayla hazeh mikol halelot. On all nights, we have bread, and this night, only matzah. Simple questions. Anybody who's gone through, well, I think that's even, an admission test for TVT, isn't it? Yeah. What are the four questions that they ask kids going to kindergarten? That's a joke. And they're simple questions. They're simple questions, and that's the way they start the symposia. Then, very interesting, in the symposia, they used to have served before the main meal, hors d'oeuvres. And the hors d'oeuvres generally focused on, again, you people would like that if you're a lot of vegetables, a lot of lettuce, and there's a very popular food that appears very often, and that is nuts and apples mixed with wine. Huh? That was very popular.
Sounds good?
All right, charoset. All right. Then, very interesting enough, on all the literature of the symposia, after they tell you that they were about, you know, they introduce the subject, they always say who was there. Who were the names? All right, the important people that might have been at this particular symposium or that particular symposium about which that author is describing. All right, just like we have Ma'aseh b'chamisha chachamim, the five sages who met in B'nai Brak, etc. Then, after that, in the discussion, when there's a discussion, everybody, you know, they take whatever theme it is, justice, beauty, etc. And everybody makes a statement, but you have to anchor that statement in some classical Greek source, whether it's Homer or Hesiod or Plato or Aristotle, whatever you want to say, you have to quote somehow, anchor it, root it in something that was said by the ancients. Just like in what we have, what's called the Midrash, which is the bulk of the Haggadah, is all kinds of statements about the Exodus, but it always is Shene'emar, as is written in the book of Exodus, and then it's quoted. The same style, the same model. Statement, quoting then an ancient source, in our case the Bible, in their case Greek people. When it's over, when the end of the Afikoman is always has songs, psalms, hymns, tributes to the God, to the king, to the emperor, to whom that night is dedicated. Okay? Songs of exaltation, etc. Just as we end the thing with a Hallel, with those six psalms that constitute the Hallel. So, point after point, there is what seems to be a very, very clear comparison or model that we have adapted from the outside. But the corker of the whole thing is this last business of the Afikoman. What is an Afikoman? Today. The matzah. The matzah that you break in the beginning, the middle matzah, you hide it, the kids look for it, they stay up, you get some gifts for them. One of the great, great Jewish creative activities. When I was a kid, got lots of good things because of it, and my kids and grandchildren get a lot of good things, and I don't want anybody to abolish it, even though I'm going to tell you that that is a distortion, that's not what it meant. But it should stay, because it's good. What does it mean? It's based on the statement. I asked for this, and I didn't ask for a
eraser,
but it doesn't matter. Ein maftirin achar pesach. Okay. Ein maftirin achar ha-pesach afikomen. Understood today, we do not complete the Passover meal except for eating the afikomen. In other words, the eating of the afikomen is the official end of the meal. After you eat the afikomen, you do birkat hamazon. Ein maftirin achar ha-pesach afikomen. We only complete the Passover meal or finish it with the eating of the afikomen. That's the way it's understood today. And that's the way we practice it today. And where does it come from, this afikoman? In later tradition, it meant gifts for children, it meant all kinds of candies, and this kind of a thing. Right? Because this is a Greek word. And later Jewish tradition didn't understand Greek, starting with the Babylonian Talmud. So they came up with all kinds of folk etymologies. What does afikoman mean in Greek? And this is Professor Lieberman's chidush. Afikoman means epikoman, the after-dinner activities. And the reference was, as the translation does very nicely with revelry, after the symposium was over, as was mentioned, the males would, having drunk wine and this and that, they would go out and have a blast at night, going through the streets, singing, yelling, this, getting a hold of women if they were around. And it was, I don't know if it was an orgy, but somewhere between revelry and orgy. All right? And that was practice. That's what went on after the symposium. So this is a very interesting statement, which really shows two things. We do not conclude the Passover celebration with afikoman, with the same activities that are going on in the outside society after their symposium. It's interesting because it shows two things. First of all, it shows an awareness that what was going on in the Passover Seder as the rabbis constructed it was somewhat close to what was going on in terms of its structure, in terms of its customs, in terms of certain things that are being done. So it shows that awareness of it, and yet it says there's nothing wrong with adopting part of it, except you have to draw a line. And the question is where you draw the line. So they drew the line that we'll adopt and adapt certain things, except for this. This is already out of bounds. And that's why that statement is so precious. because it shows an awareness of the similarity, the willingness to adopt, and not usually very often a claim is made when you're trying to introduce something new. My God, if you introduce this, then this will follow, and this will follow, and this will follow, and everything will collapse. And that kind of a claim usually is meant to stop any kind of change. Right? And it's used by all of us in some way, form, or fashion, whether it's religious or social or political, etc. Once you make change, what's the end? But the fact is that change is always made, and change has to be made. Otherwise, a tradition or whatever it is never remains relevant. The question is to have the self-confidence to know that you can make a change and you can draw the line. And that is important to be able to do, and that's what this statement reflects. So what we have in the Seder is really, in a sense, a revolution, because it's adopting it and then putting a stop to certain things, but it's also a revolution in two other ways. The content, when it was taken over by the Jews, the content was no longer an abstract philosophical discussion. The content was historically Yetziat Mitzrayim, the formation of the Jewish people in Egypt and the Exodus. So a radical change in terms of content, but there's also another radical change. Anybody know what? From what I've said so far? More in the social rather than the ideological. Mingo Bell? Who was at the symposium?
Kids.
Only the rich.
Male. Male. Male adults. Okay? That was not the case. The family was at the center of the Seder. And at the center of the family were the children. Because they're the ones that have to ask. And the Seder is built on the response to the kids. And that really follows Deuteronomy. And Exodus, by the way, the Torah, which emphasizes the children telling them and conveying to them that he got it done. So that there are a number of changes here. Who is invited? Who is the center socially? Males or the family children? What is the content? History or philosophy? And the cutting out of certain things that were found morally objectionable. And therefore, you have a fascinating instance of the ability and the willingness to adopt something that had a fantastic impact on Jewish life for 2,000 years. Now, let me add one further point. Did you notice when we read that there is an order in the Mishnah that's strange? Oh boy, the way you're looking at me, I see that not too many people did. 3 and 4. What's the problem? What is the problem? Very good.
Right.
There it says. Not we eat first. We don't eat first. There you eat.
Right.
You eat. And then come the questions, which makes sense. It's when a kid sees that there is no bread, then he says, Manishtana halai lazeh. When the kid sees that you're lying down on a couch rather than sitting in a chair, he says, In other words, the logic is you do it, and then the questions come, and then you answer. Okay? Of course, you know, we wouldn't do that today. If you have a meal first, everyone was cha-cha-ing out. By the way, that may be a problem. In any case, that was the idea. By the way, that's not the way we do it today. And it's what a pain in the neck to go through the whole Agadah and wait to eat and get hungry and this. And I want to do, you know, add some more discussion, and my wife wants to serve the food. And I know that everyone at the table identifies with her, and I'm by myself. And how you work it out, it's one of the testy times of family relationships. But it can be overcome, all right? With a little bit of communication, a little bit of goodwill, etc. Now, that's the way the Greeks did it, too. They started with food and then the discussion. In the 3rd century, the Romans changed the order. They changed it that the discussion comes first and the food later. Why they did, I don't know.
Because of
Maybe. You're probably right. Whatever the case is, they changed the order, and from Roman sources, from the late 2nd, 3rd century on, it's always the discussion and then the food. What's fascinating is we did the same thing. Mm-hmm. The Mishnah reflects the earlier thing. And the Talmud already reflects a change that obviously was made because of the change that was done in the world around. Mm-hmm. And that's why the Talmud has a lot of problems with the Mishnah, because it doesn't understand that order. Mm-hmm. All right? It doesn't understand the order, and they cut all kinds of intellectual gymnastics to try to harmonize the two. But the order was changed. And the order was changed, coincidentally, because the Romans did? Maybe yes, I doubt it. But you should know that that existed. Yes, sir?
Well, then there's a lot of wisdom in explaining the significance as you go along. If you eat and then explain, by the time you get to the explanation, people are not paying attention.
Yeah, but you're suggesting a third model, which we don't have. Eat it to explain as you go along. That's not what we do today, and that's not what they're suggesting there. Maybe your idea is an interesting model. I think we should say Kimei Southern California Tetzei Torah. Maybe that's a new model that we want to market to the world. You know, where you start eating and you talk. Yeah, maybe that's a possibility, but that's not what they're talking about. It's an interesting idea, but that doesn't fit either of the two, as far as I understand. Yes, ma'am.
That's the real meaning. Seder means order, right?
Yes.
And that's the real meaning of the Seder come from the order of the different items.
Yeah,
from what you said, it seems that's the way.
I think you're right. Yes.
And the other thing that Yashvimbin, Mr. Bim, Laila said, it's also that Roman used to sit on the big pillows.
Sure.
And we are copying.
Sure. Oh, yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I didn't go into that. Thank you very much. All right, it's obvious there are some things that we have, like the reclining. I mean, there's no big deal. You know, no one would recline. I don't think so. In American society and ancient Egypt, but that was the way the Greeks and Romans ate, especially the upper classes. And they used to do it on a regular basis. And since the Pesach, we're supposed to be free people, which means everyone is to have that, you know, that aristocratic or that free leisure and this. So they introduced reclining as part of the practice, and that clearly is Greco-Roman. But that, you could say, is superficial. All right, that was... By the way, also the wine, you should know. Generally, the symposium had 3 cups of wine. All right, beginning, middle, and end. And therefore, we have 4 because they add the kiddush to the thing. So it's really 3 plus 1, which may or may not... Yes?
Everything that you do and everything that you eat at a Seder has incredible symbolism to it. Was there symbolism to the food that they ate and the actions that they did at the symposia? And could you share some of those? Are there examples that you know of Seder? Are you aware of?
Well, I mean, the stuff that we know, the symbolism of the stuff in the Seder, it has to do with spring. I mean, that's or something that deals with Egypt, you know, the bitter herbs. No, not too much symbolism, and those are just more social practices. I never went into to a restaurant and looked at some of the appetizers and tried to ask what's the symbolism. And I think that's the way the symposia was. At least there's no indication that anybody ascribed symbolic meaning to some of the appetizers.
Wasn't philosophical concepts or anything like that?
No. That came later. There's plenty of time for that. This is, isn't it? Okay, let me, just 2 more questions, then I'd like to finish up, and then we'll take much more. 1, 2. Yeah.
When did we come to call this symposium a Seder? Because as someone mentioned, you know, it means order, yet the order was changed, and, you know.
No, the Seder is the order that the rabbis fixed.
Well, but they changed it from the Mishnah.
Yeah, it was a different order. But the idea of having a certain order, as a matter of fact, I don't know if you people do it in yours, but, you know, in the first page of almost every Haggadah, there is the order, and the kids have song, where you kind of recite the order to song. So that really became fixed as the, as the thing. But that's right from the beginning. It's already used in the Talmud. All right? Yes.
When you read the 4 questions here, it looks like the Mishnah is counting why is this night different than all other nights as one of the 4 questions. But today, there seem to be five questions, or at least that's not counted as one of the four questions. How did that happen?
I don't know. I'd like to get to the, it's much more complicated than that. And I'd be happy to, let's do it later. Because it requires just a little bit, but I'm not ducking it. I just want to postpone it and just finish up before, I see the air conditioning is terrific, so before it gets too overwhelming. Okay, let me just quickly, two points. This is not the only example we have of the rabbis of Yavne trying to fill a vacuum. Just briefly, so you'll be aware. This is, as far as we're concerned in terms of Hellenism, this is the classic example. But there are two other things that you should be aware of that affect Jewish liturgy. The first is our prayers. All right, to the best of our knowledge, all right, the prayers that we have, the Shema and the Amidah, were formulated as a part of a regular, daily, obligatory service by the rabbis of Yavne. Again, no more sacrifices, no more temple cult. What do you do? All right? That's not, you asked me the question. It was not done prepared ahead of time. It was not done pre-70. This was in response to a crisis, in response to a need to formulate a prayer service, a very interesting prayer service, which again I'll be happy to discuss how it's built and why, of the Shema and the blessings around, which is ideological, which are values, and the Amidah, which are needs, asking God for help for things that we want, health, wealth, good year, whatever it may be, on a personal level and on a national level. Pay attention next time you say the Shemona Esrei, the Amidah, during the week. Six items are personal, and six items are for the Jewish people. Okay? The other thing that was done by these rabbis, besides the daily prayer, was the high holidays. Believe it or not, the high holidays was unknown as a concept before 70. Rosh Hashanah was a Rosh Chodesh. It may be slightly more important because it was the seventh month. And the number seven was very symbolic and this. So something actually, you blew a shofar for whatever reason. All right? On the seventh month, but that's it. And Yom Kippur was a holy day in the temple. All right, the whole ritual of Yom Kippur was a high priest going into the temple, praying for forgiveness of sins of the people, of the priests, of himself, of his family, and then going into the Holy of Holies and coming out without being zapped, you know, by some divine order, etc. And it was fine. Then, of course, the Seir Lazazel, the symbolic sending of a ram, out, scapegoat. Thank you. A scapegoat out, etc. But that was temple. We don't know anything about people doing anything, and certainly not anything near what we are familiar with. But this concept of the high holidays, this weaving of themes into Rosh Hashanah, of sovereignty, malchuyot, zichronot, shofarot, of forgiveness, slicha, and then peaking on a whole day service in Yom Kippur, that's a product of rabbinic invention or reinvention of these holidays post-70. So just as an example, that the Seder does not stand alone. There are other areas, liturgy, this happens to be the home. Okay, the other two were synagogue as well as individual, that these people were active. That's the first. The last thing I want, the last point, and I saw the hand, we'll do it later, okay? Is to emphasize what I said in the beginning, which I did not deal with, and that is these kinds of changes never met with unanimity among the rabbis. I mean, we have the Seder now as if, you know, what was formulated. There's no hint in the Mishnah if there were any divergence or people that didn't want, and this, I assume there was, but that's just an assumption. But in any other area, we have the rabbis grappling with issues of the day. They just never were monolithic. There were always differences. And should there be figural art? Is that good or bad for the Jews? Different people took different positions. Should Jews learn Greek? There's a great story of an interchange of rabbis. Rabbi Abahu was probably the most Hellenized of all the rabbis. And he knew Greek, and he had... ends with the Roman governor, etc., etc. And he said, in the name of the teacher of his and everyone else, Rabbi Yochanan, that you can teach your daughter Greek. All right? At which time, one of his colleagues, who is much more conservative, small c, says to him, Rabbi Yochanan never said that. You're just using his name because that's what you want to get across. You know, you want to justify what you're doing. Interesting exchange. I don't know whether he did say it or didn't say it. But the two rabbis could argue. One obviously thought that was positive. One obviously did not think it was positive. And then the claim making, you know, you shouldn't attribute it to Rabbi Yochanan because he wouldn't have said something like that. But there's even a better and a case. And this is a story. East of the Golan, east of Israel, starting in the year 106, was the province of Arabia, Provincia Arabia, and the capital was in Bostra. Bostra, not Basra of Iraq, it's called Bostra. And there's a story, 3rd century, of a rabbi getting there. It's, by the way, interesting, Reish Lakish, he was a gladiator and this, and converted, became Shomer Shabbos, and this. And you know what happens sometimes people who move back in have a passion. And so he was there, and he saw Jews going up. This is in the, in the center of a Roman city where the north-south street, the Cardo, crossed the east-west street, the Decumanus, there was what's called a Nymphaeum. Nymphaeum was a huge fountain where you get your water. Now, you go to the faucet, turn it on. Yaakov Avinu, when he needed to have water, went to the well. All right, in a Roman city, they brought the water in to the Nymphaea, and that's where you went to get your water. But the Romans, they do things with style. It wasn't just a big pool. It was decorated. There's a tremendous facade and all kinds of statues of gods and goddesses and kings. It was really ornate. You want to call it Baroque, call it Baroque. It was ornate. And they found, by the way, in Bostra, they found this. They found the Nymphaeum. Anyways, the Jews used to go to the Nymphaeum, and they used to take water like everybody else did. Reish Lakish goes there and says, you guys can't take this water, because when you take the water, you're kind of bending down, and there are all kinds of goddesses. There are all kinds of gods. It looks like you're worshiping Avodah Zarah. It's idolatrous. So what he was really saying to the Jews, don't go there. Go 2-3 miles out of the city and get your water from wherever you get it, and that's it. Well, Reish Lakish really thought that he had saved Judaism. He had saved the Torah, and he came back to Tiberias to his friend and teacher, Rabbi Yochanan, that same Rabbi Yochanan that was quoted, and he said to Rabbi Yochanan, he said, this is what happened, and I told him, Asur, you can't do it. And Rabbi Yochanan said, don't take off your coat. Get back on the Eged bus that goes from Tveria to Batsra, because you made a mistake. All right? And then he came through with a very interesting dictum. Anything that's public domain is not forbidden. If it's in the public domain, Jews can function normally. Because you can't function in a Roman city without seeing statues on your left and right. Every street, every plaza, every building, every Nymphaeum was filled with it. That's the billboards of the Roman city. And so Rabbi Yochanan took a very different position and said, forget it. If it's in the public domain, it's okay. That's an example, a classic example. Just as we saw in saying the Shema in Greek in the synagogue in Caesarea, of two rabbis seeing the same situation, the same problem, and coming up with the different solutions. And that really does a lot, you know, in terms of explaining the complexity and the diversity, not only among Jews, which certainly there was, among the rabbis as well, then as well as today. Let me just conclude with one last midrash, which I think focuses on what we tried to say today and perhaps a little before. It's found in the Bavli Menachot, Masechet Menachot 29b. Interesting Agadah about Moses. You know, after he worked so hard to give the Torah and teach the Torah, he asked God, I'd like to see what the Jewish people do with my Torah. You know, what's going to happen? I've worked so hard. Sometimes, as parents, we say that all the time. What's going to be with our kids? You know, down the line, et cetera, especially as they're leaving the house, if they're going a little independently. So we ask that question. So God put him in a time capsule, and he came down 1,000 years later into the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Akiba. And he sat in the last row, like you guys, right in the last row, sitting, you know, very quietly. And he heard the questions and answers, and he didn't understand a damn thing. Didn't understand what they're talking about. And he began to feel faint. All right? What's happening? It's the Beit Midrash of a great teacher that God said, a great teacher, Rabbi Akiva ben Yosef, and he didn't understand what they're doing. Until one student raised a hand and said, where do you get all this information? Said to Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva says, Halacha le Moshe Misinai. This is what God gave Moses on Mount Sinai. And Moses felt better, and he went back up to heaven feeling satisfied. That's a fascinating midrash. Mm-hmm. How is it, if it's Halacha le Moshe Misinai, how come Moses didn't understand? Mm-hmm. And if the Moses didn't understand a damn thing was going on, how can you say Halacha le Moshe Misinai? But that's the tradition. The tradition began, and Halacha in the Shemi Sinai indicates the continuity. And there was reinterpretation. And there was reinvention. And there was change. And that's why Moses didn't understand. But that was his tradition. So the tradition is not that everyone's doing the same thing that Moses said 1,000 years later. That's impossible. Can't be. Society is different. People are different. Psychology is different. But the continuity is that the ongoing tradition from generation to generation. And that, I think, Midrash captures. Not a lot of Midrashim like that. Not all the rabbis were historically oriented. But that one really, really does it. Tudah rabah.